Hello, this is Mark Peacock, and welcome to the Travel Commons Podcast. This is Travel Commons Podcast 100, recorded Tuesday, July 31st, 2012. This is the podcast giving the voice of the traveler. It's more about the journey than the destination. Two topics on this edition of the Travel Commons Podcast: Southern Road Trip and breaking up with American Airlines. Well, here we are at a milestone episode number 100, 7 years and a couple of months after I started the Travel Commons Podcast. You know, it took me a year and a half to do 50 podcasts, and then another five and a half to do 50 more. So it looks like my podcast productivity is exponentially decaying, but you people keep hanging around. I do appreciate the kind words that you've sent along via Facebook and Twitter. I'm glad that so many of you find this podcast interesting and or entertaining. It's probably more than that than really anything else. It keeps me sort of plugging away at this. So now that we've got that out of the way, we can move on to your regularly scheduled podcast. So this week, changes in the job front have kept me off the road from business travel, but I've managed to fill a couple of the weeks since the last episode with some personal travel. At the end of June, the family and I headed off to San Francisco. My son scored an academic ticket to the big Geekapalooza Google I.O. conference. I think this year's event sold out in 20 minutes, and there were a very limited number of discounted academic tickets, so getting one was a bit like, you know, getting one of those golden tickets in Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. So while my son watched videos of guys skydiving with Google virtual reality glasses, and he himself dove into the intricacies of the Google Maps APIs or the latest whizzy things that Google Chrome does, my wife, daughter, and I did San Francisco tourist stuff. We rode bicycles across the Golden Gate Bridge. We rode cable cars. We, you know, hung out in hipster coffee joints. It was the sort of stuff that I've never quite found time to do in sort of the 10 to 15 years that I've been going to San Francisco on business. And then last week, I decided to do a little trip of my own, a 2,100-mile loop through the South, but more about that one later in the show. I tell you what, though, I have noticed that whenever I travel for leisure, I don't travel quite as sharp. I don't feel, you know, I don't know, as tightly wrapped, as in the zone as I do when I travel on business. I mean, on my flight out to San Francisco, I'll tell you, I hit a new level of bad planning or non-preparedness. I actually had to reach for the SkyMall catalog before the plane had even left the taxiway. Following up, I wrote a blog post last month about tipping. I received a link to really a nice sort of interactive infographic from somebody at hospitalitymanagementschools.org. I don't know, it's a website I still can't quite figure out what it is. I mean, it seems like a legit website with information about the hospitality management industry, but there's no contact information, just a web submission form. And the domain name is held in kind of proxy by GoDaddy. I don't know. It feels just a little fishy. But anyhow, the infographic, the tipping guide was good. I mean, if a little wonky on the iPhone, and it seemed to offer some reasonable advice. I mean, there's a surprising amount of emotion wrapped up in figuring out a tip amount. I mean, you want to appropriately acknowledge the service someone has given you, but then that gets combined with sort of the image you want to portray. I mean, am I a nice, generous person? Am I a sharp, you're not going to get anything by me person? I mean, looking at my own tipping, I think I do pretty well when dealing with a service person face to face, a waiter, a car valet, a hotel bellhop. But I'll tell you, I don't do so well with tipping people I don't see, like a hotel maid. Now, Rich Frazier's in the same place, you know, both about, you know, tipping cleaning staff and feeling slightly off about that. In a comment on the website, he wrote, "I agree with your take on tipping the housekeeping staff. I'm probably totally off base, but I always considered housekeeping to be a service inherent to my stay. I mean, I get that service whether I ask for it or not, as opposed to the bellhop, bartender, concierge, which are optional services." Well, you know, I mean, Rich has got a good point. And again, I mean, tipping just it just is so fraught with emotion. And I mean, and that's just dealing with the U.S. I mean, and don't get me started about international tipping. I mean, which in which countries it's an insult to tip, it's an insult not to tip, you know, which countries you just round the tab up. I don't know. It just makes my eyes roll back in my head. Now, one of the highlights of our San Francisco trip was at the end of each day, seeing what swag my son hauled back from Google I.O. I mean, these developer sessions, these developer conferences have become quite the giveaway spree as companies sort of try and recruit independent developers to their platforms. I mean, Microsoft gave away Windows 8 tablets at their last developers conference, but Google's the one that goes the deepest. I mean, over 2 days, my son got an unlocked Samsung Galaxy Nexus phone, a Chromebox, the new Google Nexus Q media streaming device / bocce ball stand-in, and then a Nexus 7 tablet. I mean, $1,200 a hardware for a $300 academic ticket. I mean, no wonder this thing sells out in 20 minutes. Now, I have to tell you, the Nexus 7 tablet was sort of the highlight of the swag bag, and it was actually the one thing that my son was really looking forward to when he was scanning the rumors about what sort of hardware they thought was going to get given away. I mean, $200, the 8 gigabit model of the Nexus 7 goes for $200, and I mean, it competes directly with the Kindle Fire, and I tell you, I think it blows it straight out of the water. The Nexus 7 runs the latest Android version 4.1, or Jelly Bean as the droid heads call it, while the Kindle Fire sits at sort of some custom version, I think stuck, because it's a custom version of version 2.3, or what they call Gingerbread. And I think in those intervening versions between Gingerbread and Jelly Bean, Google smoothed off a lot of Android's sort of sharp edges, kind of geeky sharp edges, and really significantly improved performance. I mean, for the first time with this Nexus 7, after using it, I could see this Android tablet being a real competitor to the iPad. I tell you, I also find myself liking the 7-inch form factor. Now, Steve Jobs is famous for dismissing anything less than the iPad sort of piece of paper size. And I tell you, I was surprised how much easier I found reading and web browsing on this 7-inch device, which is much lighter, as you would guess. And since most of what I use a tablet for is media consumption, as opposed to some who are kind of using it as an executive-level laptop replacement, I tell you, I'm thinking my next tablet, I may end up downsizing to the 7-inch form factor. I mean, I'll first wait and see if sort of the rumored iPad mini appears, but I'll tell you, if not, I may head down this Google route. Now, coming out of San Francisco, I sort of continued my sort of periodic trains to airport thread when I took BART, Bay Area Rapid Transit, from downtown, we were staying at the St. Francis in Union Square, to SFO for my flight home. Now, it was a Sunday, the last Sunday in June, and a nice, warm, sunny day, a rare event in San Francisco, which, of course, brought out in full force that standard San Francisco mix of street performers, cup rattlers, and clueless tourists. Now, getting through this melange with my rolling bag was my first challenge. I mean, once I got down to the station and in front of the fare machine, well, then I got quite a bit of a sticker shock. It was $8.25 to get from the Powell Street station out to SFO. Now, sure, you pay a lot more for, say, London's Heathrow Express, but that's a private train, and it's only got one stop, and that's, you know, and that's Paddington Station. The BART fare, though, this BART fare, I tell you, it's one of the bigger numbers that, you know, that I've seen for a subway system. Now, Chicago's a flat 225 from the Loop to O'Hare. Washington's metro is $3 from downtown to Reagan National Airport. Now, sure, I mean, $8.25 is, you know, cheaper than a $35, $40 cab ride, but, you know, when you compare it to whatever other folks are charging. And I'll tell you, that sticker shock only sinks in deeper when they get you on the train, and then you see how just completely beat to hell they are. I mean, now, the BART trains are sort of the same style trains as the Metro in Washington, but I'll tell you, they're in a lot worse shape. I mean, I got to find the person who thought it was a good idea to put cloth seats on a public transit train. I wished I had a plastic sheet to sit on. And I tell you, I made a beeline to the restroom once I got to SFO so I could wash my hands. It was just disgusting. It's back to taxis for me the next time I'm in SFO. Hey, if you've got a story, a comment, a question, a travel tip, the voice of the traveler, send it along. The email address, as always, comments, COMMENTS at travelcommons.com. Or you can always use sort of the voice memo app on your iPhone or something like Virtual Recorder if you're doing the Android thing to record and send in an audio comment. You can send a Twitter message to M. Peacock, or you can post your thoughts on the Travel Commons Facebook page. Or there's always the opportunity to go old school and post your thoughts on the website at travelcommons.com. First topic on today's Travel Commons podcast is Drive South, a Southern road trip. You know, as I mentioned at the top of the show, I did a sort of Great Circle road trip of the Mid-South earlier this month. Me, a full-up old 30-gigabyte click-wheel iPod, a list of restaurants and bars, a suitcase and nothing more than shorts and polo shirts and underwear, and all that loaded up into the Saab convertible. I started off by running I-65 from top to bottom, from the Indiana Toll Road down to Mobile, Alabama. Made stops in Louisville, Nashville, Birmingham, Alabama. And then we jogged over the state line to Florida, passing, you know, the huge new rebuilt version of the Florabama Bar and Grill. Had a weekend on the Gulf at Perdido Key. I then drove back west across the Mississippi Gulf Coast along US 90. You know, sort of past the rebuilt casinos in Biloxi and then past the not-so-rebuilt towns of Gulfport and past Christiane. I mean, here we are 7 years after the eye of Hurricane Katrina made landfall at Bay St. Louis, Mississippi. And the vacant lots along that coastal highway, I'll tell you, they far outnumber the rebuilt homes. Indeed, the for sale signs on vacant lots, many of them handmade with "Make Me an Offer" scrawled across the front. I mean, even those far outnumber the rebuilt homes. Well, I eventually ended up on I-10 and then drove into New Orleans for dinner, reloaded on beignets and chicory coffee the next morning, and then headed up I-55 with a lunch stop in Jackson, Mississippi before landing in Memphis for a couple of days. And then the last leg was Memphis to Sykeston, Missouri, and then back up I-57 home to Chicago. It was a 2,100-mile loop through what I think many people consider sort of flyover country. Now, the first reaction that most folks have to this itinerary is, why? I mean, it's certainly not on anyone's top 10 scenic drives list, but I'll tell you, it's always been on my list of trips to do, to stop off on some of these drive-through cities and spend a little time exploring, even if only for a couple of hours. And then there was also, I also wanted to do a bit of a nostalgia tour, visit places I'd lived, you know, sort of 25, 30 years ago. And then really most of all was to catch up with some old friends, you know, primarily in Mobile and Memphis, you know, and catch up with them physically rather than just over Facebook. But while I've been sort of thinking about this trip for a while, it's always been on the sort of the B list, always getting bumped by something else. Well, as I sort of hinted at the start of the show, my professional situation has changed, providing me with a bit of a summer sabbatical. And so with a suddenly open schedule and nothing else planned, it's sort of the perfect time to work through that sort of next tier of things to do. I took a week to do this sort of great circle route. Not too fast, but, you know, not dawdling either. I'll tell you, I came away, I had a great time, and came away with, you know, a few observations. So first, the drive, this drive, I mean, it's not as boring as you might think or fear. Now, I don't want to sugarcoat it. I-65 through northern Indiana and I-57 through Illinois are just sort of brutally not mind-numbing. I mean, flat, unending fields of corn and soybeans, you know, the monotony of which is just occasionally broken by an unending row of wind generators. I mean, they're too big, they're too huge to be called windmills. But past that, the landscape does have characters, the sort of low-lying clouds that are tied up against the hills and sort of resting in the valleys in southern Kentucky, you know, driving along the long causeways over the marshes and the bayous, first heading south into Mobile on I-65 and then coming north out of New Orleans on I-55. It's sort of the red clay of any turned-over ground in Alabama, and then the forests of southern Mississippi coming up through I-55. Now, certainly none of this is, you know, sort of the Big Sur coastal drive in California, but it's not, except for Illinois and Indiana, hundreds of miles of dreary sameness. Now, the second observation, I got to tell you, with all that windshield time, I finally found a good use for Apple's Siri. Now, I've seen the Samuel L. Jackson, Zooey Deschanel commercials, but I have never gotten Siri to be more than an annoyance. I mean, I can always find something faster myself than repeating the question three times. But I'll tell you, with both hands on the wheel and my eyes on the road, Siri was very good at reading and replying to sort of the daily flow of text messages that I think have just sort of become part of our communications flow, especially if you've got kids. I mean, the results of the read new message command was really unintelligible only once. And given my sister's tendency for sort of random punctuation and sort of weird abbreviations, it was, I gave Siri a pass on it. I thought she did actually a pretty damn good job. Now, Siri's still not the virtual assistant that Apple keeps pitching her as, but I found she does have her uses on a long drive. Now, the third sort of observation, there's good local food and beer everywhere. I mean, call it sort of the Brooklynization of America, but I'll tell you, every decent-sized city I visited on this trip had its own sort of hipster neighborhood with restaurants serving local artisan foods and local craft beers. I mean, Louisville has its unfortunately named New Lou neighborhood. Memphis has a much better named Cooper Young neighborhood. It's, you know, sensibly named at the intersection of Cooper Street and Young Avenue. And New Orleans has the Bywater District, which I think, luckily enough, is a good bit away from the French Quarter. Now, you expect good food in New Orleans. I mean, that's one of the reasons you go there. But I had very good food and beer in every other place I stopped. I mean, an example of that sort of southern local focus is restaurants using country ham in place of prosciutto, which I guess if you think about it, you know, if you think about prosciutto, it's just sort of another kind of air-dried ham, but from Italy instead of Virginia. And now at the Garage Bar in Louisville, they had a ham bar with a choice of country hams from farms in Virginia, Kentucky, and Tennessee. And at the Beauty Shop in Memphis, by the way, a great Twitter recommendation from Denrail, country ham, cantaloupe, and an arugula salad made sort of a great appetizer on a hot day. I also hit a string of really good locally made sour brown ales at craft microbreweries in Louisville and in Birmingham, Alabama. I mean, they're definitely not lawnmower beers, and I tell you, they were as good as any that I had had in Brussels this past couple of months ago. And I guess the nice thing is finding these restaurants and breweries, or kind of searching them out, had sort of the side benefit, or maybe a main benefit, of taking me out of the normal tourist spots, leaving behind the French Quarter and Beale Street. I just found I just you know I just had to look for art galleries, record stores, tattoo parlors, and people in skinny pants riding bicycles without helmets, and there I was. Another observation. Waiting for the last minute to book a hotel with Priceline's negotiator app works sometimes. Now, I'd never used Priceline's sort of opaque pricing before, sort of naming my price for an unnamed hotel room. I mean, if I'm traveling on business or with my family, I typically want things nailed down a bit tighter. I mean, in those situations, I've got a much lower appetite for risk, and I'm willing to pay more money to ensure a good experience. But on this trip, I'm by myself and I'm only looking for a clean bed and decent water pressure for the morning shower. So it seemed like the right time to give Bill Shatner a try. My first try was Friday night around, I think it was about seven at night in Louisville. I was sitting in the garage bar after my serving of Kentucky Country Ham. I fired up the iPhone, went to some websites, got a sense of the going rate at sort of reasonable hotels. It was sort of in the 75 to a buck 10 range. And so then, on the Priceline app, I bid $50 for a 3-star place near the airport. Pop-up screen from the Priceline app says, "Whoa, that's a low bid. Are you sure you want to do that?" "Yep, I'm really damn sure. That's the whole idea of this thing." And so after working through a few screens, I ended up with a great room in a very nice Holiday Inn by the airport. I ran the same place Sunday night, driving into New Orleans, and got a room at the Marriott on Canal Street for $60. But I'll tell you, during the week while in Memphis, no such luck. No one bit on my lowball bids, and I ended up in a very substandard Hampton Inn in a not-so-clean Comfort Inn. Apparently, there was some sort of, I don't know, little league tournament in town. I don't know. I don't know any others' experiences, any other listeners' experiences. But the risk-reward trade-off with Priceline bidding is real, which sort of confirmed my initial instinct. Useful tool when traveling by myself with no rigid itinerary, but not so much for family or business travel. The final observation: I tell you, if I do this trip again, I'm packing some statins, some Mevacor. I mean, after my fourth straight day of barbecue, I could sort of feel the pork fat thickening my blood. Not so thick, though, that it kept me from ordering just one last slab of ribs on the drive home. So the second topic on today's Travel Commons podcast is breaking up with American Airlines. Now, I got to tell you, my relationship with American Airlines began June 1985 when I flew from Chicago to Dallas to start my first job out of school. And now here I am 27 years and about 2.5 million miles later, and I'm feeling just about done with them. I mean, it wasn't always like that. I mean, now it's easy enough to fly American out of DFW. Indeed, I'll tell you, it's damn near impossible not to. But I went out of my way to fly American after I left Dallas, first back in Chicago and then in Philadelphia. Now, it's not too tough in Chicago. O'Hare is another American hub. But sticking with them while flying out of US Air's Philly Fortress hub, I'll tell you, that took some commitment. Over the past, say, 5 years, though, things have changed. American's competitors declared bankruptcy, cleaned up their balance sheets, and bought new planes. I mean, lousy if you're an investor with stock, an executive with options, or a creditor taking a haircut on loans, but for a customer, it kind of works out. Americans seemed proud of not going bankrupt, but as their planes got older and dingier and needed more maintenance and broke down more, and as fuel prices got higher, I'll tell you, you know, something had to give, and give it has, and not just renegotiating plane leases. I mean, at a time when you'd think American would want to take extra care customers, their service has just taken a dive. They've gotten more aggressive with add-on luggage and seating fees, and now the latest email that I got from them tells me that they're combining the balance of my older frequent flyer miles, those miles that have no expiration date, and they're combining those with the miles that expire every 18 months. And guess what? It's not like all of them no longer have an expiration date. No, it's another takeaway. They now all have that 18-month expiration date. Now, I'll tell you, for me, it's not that unexpiring mile balance. It's not a big number. But it's the change in attitude. And I guess it's a final break in what I thought I could expect from American. Will I stop flying American? No. I mean, unless they go completely under or worse, merge with US Air. I mean, they'll keep a big hub out of O'Hare, and I have lifetime platinum status with them, unless, you know, that too becomes a casualty of their takeaway mentality, or, you know, or they water it down, or they, you know, they keep watering down their status levels like we talked about in the last episode. So, you know, will I stop flying them? No. But what will stop is kind of my sense of certainly my sense of loyalty to American and giving them the benefit of the doubt of having them be my default choice. After 27 years, they're, I don't know, American's, you know, just another uncomfortable plane seat. Okay, that's it. That's the end of Travel Commons podcast number 100. 100. Let me just say that one more time. 100. I hope you all enjoyed this podcast, and I hope you decide to stay subscribed, especially those of you who have gutted that long 7-year slog since the single-digit episodes. The bridge music on today's show is from the CC Mixter and Magnatune websites, the songs in order of appearance, AWEL. Not AWEL, but AWEL, AWEL, by Stefax, Steam Train by John Williams, and Bubbly by Ruben Van Rompuy. You can find links to those and correct spellings all in the show notes. And again, thanks to everyone who has sent or posted best wishes on hitting the 100-episode mark. I'll tell you, with my travel somewhat curtailed now, I don't know when I'll have material for the next episode. However, I'm thinking about taking some of the sabbatical time to do another Travel Commons video. This time, you know, kind of sticking close to home, I'll do maybe a bit of a layover itinerary for folks who are traveling through O'Hare. When it's done, I'll post it on the website and announce it on Facebook and Twitter. I don't think I'll push it through, though, this feed, the iTunes feed, though. I just don't want to push something that big out to everyone and sort of impose upon their feeds. Watch for it in August, though. You know, between then, watch for it in August. And as always, if you have a story, thought, comment, gripe, voice of the traveler, send them along, text or audio file to comments, COMMENTS at travelcommons.com, or to mpeacock on Twitter, or write them on the Travel Commons wall on Facebook, or post them on our website at travelcommons.com. Thanks to everyone who has taken the time to send in emails, tweets, and post comments on the website. And again, until we speak again, travel safe, and thanks for stopping by the Travel Commons. Bye now.
On the road, life is hell. Strange bed in a lonely motel. But one thing can ease my mind, the warm woman that I left behind. California to Carolina, she calls me up and there's nothing finer. And when the tears start falling, crying into the phone.